Turn the book to the book of Ecclesiastes. We are in the midst of a new series, just started last week, on the book of Ecclesiastes. If you have a tough time finding it, best thing is to find the book of Psalms, hang a right to the book of Proverbs, and hang a right to the book of Ecclesiastes, and you will find it there. We started last Sunday this series, which we will spend a few months in, seeing that last week was Thanksgiving and that many of you were gone for Thanksgiving. I just want to do a quick recap. I'm not going to spend a lot of time this morning doing that because we have many, many verses to go through. A lot of stuff to hit upon this morning, but just give you a quick recap. First of all, the book's author is Solomon. I know there's some debate over that, but I think the preponderance of evidence points towards Solomon. Who is Solomon? He, king of Jerusalem, the son of King David, the son of David and Bathsheba, the second child, the first child they lost. Solomon is their son. A man of great privilege, a man of great wisdom, a man of great insight, supernatural wisdom. But as we saw last week, knowing truth and living truth are not necessarily synonymous. The book Ecclesiastes gains its name, or its origin of its name, is found in the pseudonym that Solomon uses for himself. In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon calls himself the preacher. In the Hebrew, it's the word koeleth. In the Greek, it's the word ekklesia, or derivative thereof. Therefore, the book of Ecclesiastes. The preacher is the one who gathers. Ekklesia, ecclesiology, the study of the church, the study of the gathering, the study of God's people, the study of the congregation. So that's where we get the name Ecclesiastes from. You can see the name preacher in verse 1 of the first chapter. We'll come across it again. That's where we get the name from. The purpose of the book, and this is really important to remember as you study it, the purpose of the book of Ecclesiastes is to evaluate the quest of one trying to find meaning, joy, satisfaction in this world without having God at its center. That's the whole purpose. There's a quest, there's a search to try to discover meaning, joy, and satisfaction in this world without having God in it. That's the whole purpose of the book, the evaluation. And last week, as we introduced the book, the summary of Solomon, which he gives in the first 11 verses, is it's vanity of vanities. It's emptiness. It's blahness. It's worthlessness. To try and live a life here under the sun, the word, the phrase he uses often, to try to do that without having God is worthless. It's vanity of vanities. Is Solomon's assessment in reviewing his life, a life where he spent a lot of it trying to live it without God. He believed in God, but he tried to live without God in it. He sums it up as vanity of vanities. Now, we're educated people here. We should have a response to that. At least some of us should. Some of us who want to argue that summary should. And one of the arguments that some give in light of Solomon's assessment is maybe he didn't have the kind of experiences we did or do. I mean, we're well-educated people. We live in the age of the internet. We have lots of information. We come from a nice city. I mean, people argue that Vancouver is the greatest of all cities, great place to live. Things are going pretty well here, especially in comparison to much of the world, right? People are doing good. We got good schools, nice restaurants, lots of things to do, creation all around us, all of that type of stuff. Maybe Solomon didn't experience the things we have. He was limited, maybe. Maybe that's it. Maybe he wasn't as cosmopolitan as we are, connected like we are. I mean, if you're going to tackle a subject like this one, meaning of life, we should at least question the qualifications of the guy writing the book, right? I mean, if someone's going to speak into your life about meaning and joy and satisfaction, we should ask some questions. What gives you the right of all people to speak into it? That leads into today's passage. Look at verse 12 of chapter 1. That's where we left off last week, verse 11. The rest of chapter 1, Solomon lays out his qualifications. Okay? He lays out his resume. Those types of things. Let me read verses 12 to 15 with you. I, the preacher, there's the word again, the koeleth, the one who gathers, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. That's why we call this series Chasing the Wind. You'll see that phrase come up over and over. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Let's just stop there. So what do we see as Solomon's qualifications? Number one says he was king. We've heard that before. He was king. He was king of Jerusalem. He was the king that followed his father David. But what we haven't talked about is Solomon was a king at a time of great peace. He was also a king that inherited a large amount of booty, cash, stuff from his father David. Those are two good combinations. If you're a ruler of a nation, you have much, much inherited, and you're living in a time of peace where you don't have great expenditures, that's a pretty good deal. That's what Solomon inherited. He was a king at a time of peace, 40 years of peace, no battles to fight, those times of things. It was a time of great peace and great wealth. But Solomon, we read here, wasn't just a king. He was, secondly, the wisest in the land. We talked about that last week. Solomon, he was wise, but he then became supernaturally wise through the gifting of God. We read, and if you ever read the story of Solomon, which is depicted for us in 1 Kings 1 to 11, that he was so wise, leaders of Gentile nations would come and sit at his feet, enemy nations. He was so renowned as one who could speak words of wisdom worth listening to, that enemy leaders, enemies of his land would come and listen to him. Now, we read that, but that's nuts. That would be like leaders of the Al-Qaeda sending people from their organization to sit at the feet of Stephen Harper. I mean, it's crazy on so many levels, I understand, but you get my point. His renown was worldwide, to the ends of the earth. He was that kind of individual. Now, in our world in 2008, because we are, I need to be kind about this, because we are so money conscious, how about that? All right? We are overly apt to give ears to those who have it, even if their life and insight are sorely lacking. Is that not true? We do it with people who have power and fame as well, right? If you ever watch Entertainment Tonight, right, they interview people like Miley Cyrus. Who are you voting for? I don't even think she's old enough to vote, honestly. But they ask her, why? Why do we care what Miley Cyrus thinks? She sings some songs. She does the Disney thing. Her dad's got a bad mullet. All of that, right? That's Miley Cyrus. Why do we care about Miley Cyrus? Because she's famous, right? She's got some power. She's got some cash. People follow her. So we are overly apt to give ears to people just because they're famous and have some money. However, that's not the case with Solomon. In fact, they listened to Solomon in spite of his money and power. He's that kind of individual. That was Solomon. He was a king. He was wise. He was living at a time of peace. And because of all of that, because he had the means, his situation was perfect. And what we see in verse 13, look at verse 13 of chapter 1. Solomon was able to seek out answers. He had free time, right? And big bucks. That's a good combination. It's a great combination. He says this, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. He could get into everything, but with all honesty, look what he also states in the same verse, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Which leads to the question, why, Solomon? Why is that unhappy? Why is that an unhappy business? Well, I think the best answer is one that I found. I want to read a commentator that was speaking into this. He puts it this way. Solomon, in writing this, that it's unhappy business, is recognizing the fact that it is difficult for us to discover answers, yet we have this inerrant need to seek them out. But there is something wrong inside of us. We sense an overwhelming curiosity to discover the secrets of life around us, yet we find ourselves perplexed by inadequate understanding. We cannot put it all together. In other words, we have this inbuilt drive in us to find answers, find meaning, find satisfaction, but there's also something inbuilt in us that we discover points out that we can't find it. That's a bad combination as well. He says as much. Look at verses 14 and 15. It's hammered home here. He says, I have seen everything, verse 14. I've seen everything. Seen it all. Yet he concludes, what is crooked in verse 15 cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. In other words, it's hard to discover the answers to life. There's something in us that prevents us from connecting all of it. You ever felt like that with your family member, for example? You know, family member has gone off the rails and you want to cure them, right? You want to help them. You just want to grab him or her by the shoulders and just shake him and go, come on, man, let's get this figured out. And you just can't, and that drives you crazy. It's a lot of things in life like that. We look, we have a desire, but we can't figure it out. And also, no matter how much information we discover, we long to find. At the very end of verse 15, he says, what is lacking can't be counted. That was Solomon's problem. I desire it, I lack something, but I can't get it. You ever felt like that? His qualifications continue to be laid out in verses 16 to 18. So he's a king, he's wise, he's got much stuff, he's got the time, resources, all of that. Everything is laid out. He goes on to say this in verse 16. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is vexation, kind of fancy word for frustration. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow, which is an encouraging word for all of you who are students. Welcome. I mean, that's a great thing, right? I mean, good deal. Now, here's another question. How does knowledge increase sorrow? Like, lack of knowledge really freaks us out on exam day especially, right? But how does the increase of knowledge increase sorrow? Here's a quote by Isaac Newton. Most of us know who Isaac Newton was, mathematician, a chemist, astronomer, theologian. At the end of his life, this is what Isaac Newton says. I have been paddling in the shallows of a great ocean of knowledge. What Isaac Newton is saying is exactly what Solomon is saying at the end of his life. That the more you discover, the more you discover what you don't know. In other words, Sir Isaac Newton says, you know, I've been playing in the shallow end of the pool my whole life. There's so much out there that I can't attain. Solomon felt the same thing about 3,000 years before Isaac Newton. So those are Solomon's credentials, right? King, all that stuff. I don't need to review it with you. But that's his resume. So we ask the question on the front end, what gives you the right to speak into my life? Pretty good right. At least worth listening to. Is that fair? It's worth listening to. So let's now look at the quest. What does Solomon, with all of that as his backing, what does he give himself to find joy, meaning, and satisfaction? Let's look at verse 1 of chapter 2. Here we go. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. I love it. That phrase cracks me up. It really does. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. I don't know why that cracks me up. It just does. Just kind of walking down the street, talking to himself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad and of pleasure. What use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. This was his starting point. What was it? It's booze and laughter. I'm trying to discover what I could tell all the children of man, women, that's his phrase. I'm trying to discover how I can speak into their life to help them find joy and satisfaction. So let's begin here. Booze and laughter. Now we have to fill in the blanks somewhat to get a sense on how good a partier Solomon was. And he was a good partier. Let me just give you a layout of this. We discover this in 1 Kings 4. Verses 22 and 23. It's on the screen behind me. It says this about Solomon. Solomon's provision for one day, was 30 cores. Cores were 10 bushels. A core was 10 bushels. So 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, not skinny, fat oxen, and 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, Robux, I don't know what that is, but it's something. Robux and fat and foul, chickens, ducks, things like that. This is his needs for one day. It's estimated this would feed between 10 and 20,000 people, meaning he had an entourage, right? He had a posse. He had a group. He had his fellas. He rolled with people. Whatever you wanted. He did it well. That's Solomon. One day. That's him. He did it very, very well. In verses 1 to 3, if you really... Now, sometimes you kind of... You need to read Scripture, and don't read it too fast. But you know what verses 1 to 3 are to me as I read it? They're really a dolled-up version of what happens around way too many office water coolers. High school hallways and college dorms in our city every day. He's kind of reviewing, right? Did you hear about Jimmy? Jimmy got so loaded on Friday. Unbelievable. Susie, she got drunk, slept with Jim, puked on the carpet. John got way too drunk at the office party, hit on the boss's wife, got fired. And then they add something like this. It was so hilarious. Really? 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 Solomon's assessment, a guy who partied very well, says it's foolish and accomplishes nothing. You may be the life of the party, but are you one who's invited to speak into the life of another? And there's no doubt that booze loosens up tensions at a party, but does it lead to meaningful conversation? Solomon goes on to talk about what he gave himself to in verses 4 to 8, and this is 4 to 8, and this is awesome. This is just Cole's notes version. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Who doesn't do that, though? I bought male and female slaves. Slaves, hired out servants, but I don't want to make excuses for Solomon, okay? These are different than how we define slavery, but it's not great either, okay? Can we put ourselves in the middle there? I brought male and female slaves, had slaves who were born into my house, also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, not some, many. The delight of the children of man. So what do we got here in verses 4 to 8? Well, this is the Playboy Mansion circa 930 BC. And I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. You think, well, boy, that's a little sacrilege. No, that's it. It's what he's laying out. I mean, check it out. Solomon's vast estate, houses and parks and vineyards and pools and servants and staff and silver and gold and treasure. Entertainment, you don't read it here, but in the original language, Jimmy Buffett's on at 8. Right? Carrot Top 10. Celine's at midnight. Right? And what happens at Solomon's stays at Solomon's. And women. He's got women. 300 concubines, it says in the book of 1 Kings. 700 wives. Can you imagine? And he says, to the delight. You can insert any joke you want in here. I'm not going to insert any of them, but you can on your way home. Solomon gave himself to this. His own house, tells us in the book of 1 Kings, took 14 years to build. And it's not because it got caught up in ordinances, right? It's stuck at City Hall trying to get the proper requirements. That's not the reason it took 14 years. The temple took 7. His own house took 14. I ask you, read 1 Kings 10, just about the bling. Unbelievable. Gold was so prevalent during the time of King Solomon that nobody even, I mean, silver was a joke. You read that in the book 1 Kings chapter 10 and 11. Today, even now, if you travel to Jerusalem, southwest of Jerusalem, there exist today vast depressions in the earth, which are called the Pools of Solomon. You can see them there today that were used to water his great forests. So what were his qualifications as a partier? Pleasure, laughter, good wine, big entourage, lots of people every day. Verses 9 to 11. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered, here's a summary, all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. In reflection, what Solomon does, with no amount of self-aggrandizing, he says this about himself: I was the greatest who has ever lived. I was the greatest who has ever lived. I surpassed all who came before me. Whatever I saw, I grabbed. Whatever my heart wanted, I took. Can I say this as a very necessary point of application in 2008 on the west side of Vancouver? Just because you want and can doesn't mean you should. It's one of the greatest lies that we have conformed to in our culture. We have a want, we have a means, therefore it's okay. As long as we don't go into debt, it's okay. That's our guidepost. Solomon says, I followed my heart. Whatever my heart wanted, I took. And you know what? That sounds kind of nice. That's like a precious moment statement. You throw heart in there, but hearts are good, right? Jeremiah 17:9 says this about the heart. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? We need to constantly question the longings of our heart. Just because we long for it doesn't mean it's good. Look back at second verse of chapter 2. Solomon concludes in chapter 2, verse 2, that his pursuit of pleasure was madness and folly. But look at what he says this in light of in verse 3. He says, I search with my heart how to cheer my body. So verse 2, he says, this is madness and folly, even though I followed my heart how to cheer my body. Hang a right, go to chapter 10, verse 2. Solomon speaks of the heart here, and this is something we need to wrestle with. Chapter 10, verse 2, love hearing your Bibles flip, as I say all the time. A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. This is why I get the heebie-jeebies. I don't know how to say it any better than that. This is why I get the heebie-jeebies anytime I hear a follower of Jesus say, I just need to be true to myself. Why would you want to be true to yourself? I know it sounds good on a Starbucks cup, but there's a good chance the last person you should be true to is yourself. You know yourself better than anybody else. I don't want to be true to myself. Paul's take on this in Colossians 3, in assessing what a follower of Jesus is, says this: you have died and your life is now hidden with Christ. Jesus puts it this way: every day a follower of me has to pick up his cross. What does that mean? Has to die to self and follow me. Paul puts it a different way in Philippians 1 when he says, to live is Christ. Our call as followers of Jesus is to die to self and be about Jesus. We have to question everything our heart longs after and make sure that every one of those longings, every one of those thoughts are brought into obedience to Jesus. That's our call. And I know you don't hear this on TV. I know that. That's not a bad thing. If you can read Scripture without having a conflict with society day after day after day, you're not reading it right. It should butt up against culture all the time. And that, the very fact that it butts up against culture, should give you some confidence that, you know what, this may be of God. Don't you think? Here we go. You talk about it over meatloaf. Most often when the Bible talks about the heart, tofu loaf, I guess I should probably say, in this place. Most of the time when the Bible talks about the heart, it is referring to the totality, the essence of who we are. When we use language like Jesus is in my heart, which we use sometimes too often, what we're talking about is that, not that Jesus is in the heart organ. I hope we know that, right? My kids don't understand that yet. They don't. But when we talk about the heart, we're talking about the totality, the essence of who we are. That's why Jesus says in places, blessed are the pure in heart. Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He said from within, out of the heart of man comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery. That's also why Jesus said, we are to love God with all of our hearts. And when you love God with all of your hearts, you can trust your heart because you will love what God loves. That's what I think. That's why I think Augustine, I believe it's Augustine, forgive me, I may have been sleeping in that class, why Augustine said, love God and do what you please. So when you love God, you love the things that God loves. You love His creation, neighbors, friends. Now, that is not to suggest in all of this that there isn't some measure of satisfaction in this for Solomon. Look at verse 10. He says as much. He says, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all of my toil. What was his reward for all of his toil? The pleasure in the act. In other words, I found some pleasure in the moment, and that was my reward, the pleasure in the moment, the fleeting pleasure of the moment. And that's our world, isn't it, Westside? Continually running after fleeting pleasures of the moment, but finding nothing long-lasting. And after considering it all, Solomon concludes that all of this, wine, women, song, forest, Robux, all of that stuff was vanity. Right? It's like chasing the wind. And for some of you, I would say at this point, for some of you, you go, I agree. If you're going to spend day after day after day just partying, having sex, sleeping with whoever, you know, bringing entertainment, I can see how after a period of time you will go, that's not fulfilling to me. I can see how that would be very empty after a while. You don't even have to be a follower of God to conclude that. There's a lot of atheistic moralists living in our world today that have concluded the same thing, that are really good people, very moral people, very ethical people. So too did Solomon conclude this. That's why he goes on and says, look at verse 12. So I turned. I turned from this to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Why don't we just stop there? So what is Solomon saying? Well, there's a number of things in here, but let me wrap this up really simply. Solomon says, I made the move from hedonism to wise living, from seeking pleasure day after day to wise living. I gave myself to be a good citizen, to be a good contributor to society, right? I recycle now. I got rid of the big rig. I drive a smart car. I run in a 10K every once in a while. I wear the ribbon. I don't eat meat anymore. This is the normal progression in our culture, by the way, especially for people who have great wealth and power. They move from accumulation to philanthropy. We see it every day. But here's the question I want to wrestle with you, Westside, because this is so prevalent today. Have you ever asked why? Why is this? I mean, this was written 3,000 years ago. Why? Why do we move from accumulation, hedonism, self-pleasure, find it wanting, and then we go the opposite and say, well, I'm going to become a wise living individual. I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going to go from hoarding to giving. Why? Well, I mean, an obvious answer is because it's good. Okay, why? Why is it good? Why is going from accumulation to generosity good? Because it's helpful. Giving is better than hoarding. Again, I ask the question, why? Have you ever asked if perhaps this move that is so commonplace in our world today, This move from hoarding to giving isn't simply a demonstration that something is missing. That it's not simply an act of goodness, but it's an act of emptiness. Just lived out a different way. So whether you spend $1 million and bring in a bunch of good-looking women and good booze, or you give $1 million away, both are birthed out of the same place. Loneliness. Emptiness. Looking for something bigger than yourself. It is so commonplace. But helping others is much better than drinking and partying your life away. I think most of us would agree with that. I agree with that. Solomon agrees with that. Look at verse 13. He says, there's more gain in wisdom than in folly. If Solomon were to choose between what he lays out in verses 1 to 11, all that stuff we went through before, and wise living, he would choose wise living. He says, that's better. It's better. But here is the conclusion based on the fact that there is more to life than the here and now. Look at verse 14 halfway through. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity for of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have long been forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. In other words, the end result for the wise and the end result for the partier, the fool, is the same. They all die. Isn't that so fun to say? Right? Isn't that happy? Happy clappy. Right? But remember the purpose of this book. So how do you find joy, meaning, and satisfaction? It's not a book that's discussing what's good and what's bad, or what's evil and what's right and not evil, what's dark and light. It's how do you find eternal satisfaction? Is it possible under the sun, so to speak, to find it doing this? Solomon's response is no. But what about something else? Let's look at one more option, starting at verse 18. How about good old-fashioned hard work? Remember, though, get a job and work hard. Look at verse 18. I hated all my toil. It's awesome. That's great. In which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. That he'll be a master of all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This is also vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation, again, frustration. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. What Solomon does here as we get closer to closing our time this morning, he reflects on his life of toil and hard work, and he asks the question, what about it? I worked hard, I got up early, I worked late, proved faithful, built a conglomerate. There's value and honor in that, isn't there? Isn't there value and honor in just good old-fashioned hard work? That's what he's asking. Solomon's conclusion, verse 18, I hated it all. I hated my toil in which I toiled under the sun. And the question is why? Why? It's a great answer, because I have to give it to my kids. I have to give it to my business partners, my young bucks that are coming up under me. That's what he says in verse 18. Seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows, he questions in verse 19, whether they will be wise or not. And he hammers this home. If you look at verse 21, I worked hard all my life. I did my job, missed holidays, right? Drove 2 hours to and from work every day to work and work and work. And then he says in verse 21, I leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. You know, as I studied and prepared for this time together this week, so I was reading over that. You know, I don't read this as much as a repulsion towards leaving something for kids. You know, I have kids. I have two boys. At the end of my life, when I've saved up that $20 that I think I'll be able to save, I think I'll find great joy to be able to give them something. I hope they spend it well. right? They don't go to Max that day and get about 4 Slurpees and, you know, a bunch of sour keys, which they would do today. I hope they're wise with the money. And I'll find joy in that. I don't read it as much about that, however. I read this being about a guy lamenting the fact that he spent a lot of time working for stuff and questioning what it amounted to. It's going to be left behind anyways. I should have spent my time on more important things. We'll talk about what those more important things are when we conclude our time. But I don't think Solomon's biggest concern is that the money he has accumulated is going to be wasted. I don't think that's his biggest concern. I think he's questioning how he spent his life. And I think there's an application in here to every one of us. Every mom and dad, every husband and wife, every single one of us. Those of you that are starting out your careers right now, those of you that are going through school right now, how are you going to spend your life? Are you working hard but letting someone else raise your kids? Are you driving 2 hours to work every day so you can have a bigger yard, but you haven't been energetic enough in months to play in it with your kids? Are you and your spouse simply roommates? Truth be told, just mortgage helpers for one another. Have you sacrificed time that should be going to making love to your spouse, reading with your kids, cuddling on the couch, simply because you want to drive a nicer car? Man, it's nice and quiet in here. This doesn't preach well on the west side of Vancouver. And why do we do it? You know why we do it? So when we go to the parties in verses 1 to 11, and we're drinking a nice glass of wine, we can tell the person we're in a conversation with, whom we don't really know, who doesn't really care about us, who won't even remember the conversation, that we can tell them about that nice car and the nice house and our 2 kids who, if truth be told, we haven't played or prayed with in the last 2 months. Because we give more value to that. We got to wrestle with this stuff. We got to do family and jobs and money different. And what does all the accumulation result in? Look at verse 23. It keeps us up at night. It overpromises and underdelivers, because ironically, in spite of its emptiness, we worry about losing it. And if you don't believe me, turn on the news tonight. Solomon says in verse 23, even in the night his heart does not rest. I've said a couple times, the book of Ecclesiastes was written about 3,000 years ago. What I've discovered, and what you probably have discovered in your own life, is that there are a lot of people that write their own version of the book of Ecclesiastes all the time. They don't know the book of Ecclesiastes, may not have any idea who Solomon is, but the questions that Solomon is wrestling with, they wrestle with. I came across one poet, one songwriter. He put it this way. He says, the sleepless nights and endless days, mini skirts and serving trays, waking up from rain delays and selling sex for pocket change, living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, lost inside this bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal. Driving cars we can't afford just to ensure we're never bored. Living off our own accord between coffee grinds and corner stores. Limousines and cigarettes, chasing dreams with fishing nets. Long weekends with no regrets, because no one here is taking bets. I need someone to believe in, someone to fill this space with grace, to look into my eyes and touch my face, to make me feel alive today, someone to make me strong, someone to make me belong, someone to make it all right, someone to make me feel alive. You know, that sounds good reading. It even sounds better when it's done live or on video. I want to show the video of this. We had a little bit of problem in the first. I want to see and hope that it works in the second. We got it up there, guys? Thank you.
Well, sleepless nights and endless days, mini skirts and serving trays, waking up from rain delays and selling sex for pocket change and living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, and lost inside a bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal. And I need someone to believe in. And driving cars we can't afford, just to making sure we're never bored, living off our own accord between coffee grinds and corner stores, limousines and cigarettes, we're chasing dreams with fishing nets and long weekends without regrets. Well, no one here is taking meds, and I need someone to believe in. Yeah, someone to fill the space with grace, to look into my eyes and touch my face, to make me feel alive today. Someone to make me strong, someone to make me be loved, someone to make it alright, someone to make me feel. And stretching out like rubber bands to kiss the cheeks and shake the hands in pool halls and wonderlands with strong arms and no legs to stand, and getting by on hand-me-downs with your tips, your drinks, your buying rounds. Back to my old stomping grounds like children in the lost and found.
Can bring the lights up. Thanks, guys. I need someone to believe in, someone to fill this space with grace, to look into my eyes and touch my face, to make me feel alive today, someone to make me strong, someone to make me belong, someone to make it all right, someone to make me feel alive. It's the book of Ecclesiastes. So what's the solution? The solution is found in verses 24 to 26, and we'll close with this. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. That is, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? That's the answer. Apart from him, who can eat or have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he's given the business of gathering and collecting, kind of going through life. Only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after wind. Solomon's answer, in reflection of this part of his life, joy comes from God. It says, for apart from him, he can't have enjoyment. One of the mistakes that you or I would make in reading the book of Ecclesiastes is to read it as Solomon down on enjoyment. That's not the purpose of the book. In fact, the big theme of the book is all of these things point to something, more specifically, someone. I have said this often. Nobody should enjoy this life more than people who know the God who has given it to us. Nobody should enjoy friendships and parties and sex and relationships and food and recreation and creation. All of it more than the one who knows the giver of all good and perfect gifts. However, the mistake we make so often and our world makes is falling in love more with the gifts than the giver. That's the point of Ecclesiastes. Enjoyment's a good thing. But enjoyment isn't found in the things or the people. It's a gift of God. Verse 26 says, the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. How do we please God? How do we please God? The answer over and over and over in several places in the New Testament is, without faith, it's impossible to please him. So how do we please God? Believe, trust, follow. Where are you finding and looking for your joy? I think that's the question, isn't it, in all of this? Where are you looking? And if you know God and his son Jesus, as I asked last week, how are you doing in your life in light of the events that are going on? What are you pursuing? Where's your joy? What's coming out of your heart? And those of you who have been striving for this, looking for meaning, stop searching out there and come to Jesus. Follow, trust, believe Jesus. That's the answer.